Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to read articles from the most current July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. We're going to start off with an article about Tim Buckley, who's Jeff Buckley's dad, who died 50 years ago of a tragic overdose. And also a short interview with Moody Blues singer Justin Haywood, and a classic album review of Into the Great Wide Open by Tom Petty. And we start off with the article about Tim Buckley titled Song of the Magician. 50 years since his tragic overdose, Tim Buckley remains the patron saint of musicians who risk everything to unlock transcendence, a quest encapsulated in his audacious mid-career masterpiece, Star Sailor. Turning his back on fame and fortune, leaning into the unknown, was where he was lost, but also found. It was like he came into possession of his music, discovers Grayson Haver Curran. It was the summer of 1968, the Newport Folk Festival. Bob Dylan had started a revolution there 3 years earlier with his Sunburst Fender. Tim Buckley, with his tidy curls and a 12-string acoustic, would suggest a subtler one. I'll introduce a gentleman who, in the great Ogden Nash tradition of poetry, has been writing and singing his own songs in a fairly modern idiom, announced that afternoon's MC, the songwriter Oscar Brand. It sits, however, very comfortably on a fine bed of old folk music. Buckley, however, did not play old folk music that day, backed only by street-savvy conga player Carter C.C. Collins and Juilliard-trained vibraphonist David Friedman. He prowled through the serpentine, then unreleased buzzin' fly, vibraphone tucked between chords like jewels. He strummed Wayfaring Stranger to pieces, then unfurled his voice in Operatic Acts for the Dolphins by his hero, Fred Neil. It was aggressive, ecstatic, and urgent. The crowd exploded. Here's a little bit of a song, Buzzin' Fly, by Tim Buckley.
Everywhere I go.
The set would have ended there had Brand not jumped in, suggesting an encore. Someone in the audience yelled for Morning Glory, the last track on 1967's Goodbye and Hello. Buckley assented. Here's part of that song, Morning Glory, by Tim Buckley.
I lit my purest candle close to mine window, hoping it would catch the eye of any vagabond who passed it by. And I waited in my fleeting house. Before he came, I felt him drawing near. And as he neared, I felt the ancient fear that he had come to wound my door and jeer. And I waited in my fleeting house. Tell me stories, I call to the hobo. Stories of cold, I smile at the hobo. Stories of old, I melt to the hobo. And he stood before my fleeting house.
Well, I'll do a song we learned off our second album, Buckley said, he and the crowd laughing at the implication. He was moving so fast that last year's band no longer existed. The album, a relic from a seemingly distant aeon. It was exciting because it was new, Collins tells Mojo from his home in Hawaii. Nobody was using vibraphone in folk music, or whatever it is we were doing, these jazz players mixed with folk. It allowed us to take more adventures. Later that year, Collins, Friedman, and Buckley were the core of the band that recorded Happy Sad, an impressionistic folk jazz wonder about love lost and gained, rendered in Buckley's messianic range, maybe as wide as 5.5 octaves. A month before its release in April 1969, Buckley was already over that, too, plus the heartthrob scene his previous two albums had created. When a tall blonde fan rushed the stage to throw a red carnation at his feet during a set at New York's Philharmonic Hall, the divorced father to a kid named Jeff, whom he only met once, scooped the flower, chewed the petals, and spat them out. "That really tastes terrible," he said. I really wish people would try to live their own lives and stop trying to make musicians do it for them, he told the New York Times' Michaela Williams, who reported the flower-eating incident. There's a lot more to music than sex. I play heart music. Buckley went on to say that his fans had forsaken the country's prized jazz artist, raved about Milt Jackson and Miles Davis, and swore that he would soon step away from esteemed theaters, altogether and into jazz clubs. My new songs aren't dazzling. It's not 2 minutes and 50 seconds of rock'em sock'em, he said. I guess it's pretty demanding. Buckley was just getting started. By the end of the year, he would begin a phase of recording, embracing 1970s Lorca and Star Sailor, that would break beyond the bounds of folk, rock, and even jazz, incorporating surrealism, tape music, an avant-garde composition into songs that remained heart music. And as promised, he would lead an explosive improvisational band into little clubs, bending songs until they broke. Buckley became a model for the endlessly experimental songwriter. Tim was always frustrated by any boundaries superimposed on his will, says guitarist Lee Underwood, Buckley's longest-lasting collaborator. We were caught in the middle between the commercialization of music and the improvisation of music. Lorca and Star Sailor represented commercial hearsay, costing Buckley most of the fans he'd gained. As the dreamy kid born on Valentine's Day, 1947. When he died in 1975 at 28, of what appears to have been an accidental drug overdose, he was mounting something like a comeback with a series of funky and lascivious records. But those early eccentric outliers represented the peak of his vision and served as a template for waves of restless musicians to come. Commercial expectations be damned. Show business is fine, but I'm pretty much involved in music alone, in playing it and performing it, and in entertaining, Buckley said in 1972. The failure of Star Sailor, still fresh, as he prepared to tour with Frank Zappa. Rock? I've really never known a rock musician that could talk to for longer than 5 minutes at one time. What is there to talk about? When Tim Buckley gave Carter Collins a compliment, the conga player saw not only an in, but his way out, too. Collins had been raised in the foster care system of Boston and dropped out of high school. Street musicians captivated him, and he eventually joined them on drums, strapping his instrument to his chest everywhere he went. By the winter of 1967, he'd played with a few bands and singers, including Ritchie Havens, and was living rent-free at Bard College in upstate New York. When word came that Buckley, who had released his debut album months earlier, was coming to play, a few students asked Collins to join an ad hoc backing band. After four tunes, Tim was tired of it. Collins remembers the ensemble included Chevy Chase, Donald Fagen, and Walter Becker. He waved the back of his hand toward me, put his guitar away, and said, "I only want him to play." With Buckley's tight curls and serious visage, Collins assumed he was another Dylan knockoff. He was stunned by his vocal range and focus, plus the way his songs made people in Bard's packed house cry. Buckley told Collins he liked him. "Why the fuck?" Collins responded. "Don't you hire me then?" 2 weeks later, Carter arrived in New York City to meet Herb Cohen, the impresario who had recently started managing Zappa and Buckley. Smitten with Buckley's songs and face, Cohen saw a potential star and landed him a deal with Elektra Records. Collins was swept up in the gathering whirlwind of Buckley's career. Shows on both coasts, stints living together along the California shore in Venice, the June 1967 session for Hello, for Goodbye, and Hello. When an artist hears their first record, they sometimes cringe. That's good, because then it means that the next one is going to be a lot better, Elektra founder Jack Holzman remembered on a Buckley fan site in 1999. That was the case with Tim. The second album had magic. Momentum was building. They played Carnegie Hall with Pete Seeger in the fall of 1967, and 6 months later played the chaotic first night at Bill Graham's Fillmore East, joining Albert King and Big Brother and the Holding Company. Buckley's band briefly became regulars, supporting the Byrds and then Jeff Beck. Buckley has a tendency to meander, Billboard said, of that one. But his lyrics pervaded the theater with strong effect. It felt unprecedented to have a black man playing alongside a white guy in this folk world, remembers C.C. Collins. The audience response was incredible. These few months were critical for Buckley's development. Since 1966, Lee Underwood has been his lead guitarist. When Underwood took a short break, though, the band needed something else. Collins had met Friedman, the vibist, through mutual friends, even crashing at his apartment. He encouraged him to see Buckley perform and, in turn, for Buckley to hire him. Half a century later, Friedman admitted he, too, thought Buckley was another Dylan stand-in. Underwood returned in time to make Buckley's third album at the end of 1968. This band, now with John Miller, a bassist who had just graduated from the University of Michigan, and seen Buckley perform at the famous Canterbury House there, thrilled him. I talked about jazz, jazz artist, improvisation, the value of moving into improvisation to expand the total scope of the music, Underwood says. Timmy turned to me as a guru, giving him the confidence to see himself as a new composer. That album, Happy Sad, was his first major opportunity to get into jazz. Tim's debut into serious improvisational work. We were moving in a new direction. Buckley had always been cavalier about his recording contract, but as the 60s ended, he began to take the matter more seriously. For years, the company that would soon become Warner Brothers flirted with buying Elektra from Holdsman, who had launched it from his dorm room in the 1950s. Nearing 40, Holdsman was looking to retire to a home he was building in Hawaii and to secure global distribution for his company. He walked away with $10 million and a commitment to stay at the label for 3 more years. I knew Jack Holdsman was going to sell his company, which really upset me, Buckley recalled in a 1974 Zig Zag interview. I figured, well, I'm going to do what I think is best and get a contract so that I can continue at the rate I was going. The new contract was with Straight Records, Herb Cohen's novel partnership with Zappa to release records with some commercial appeal. Cohen wanted something from Buckley he could sell. There were two problems. Buckley owned Elektra, one owed Elektra one more record, and he had already assembled a band with something other than popularity in mind. Underwood had become friends with bassist John Balkin, an occasional Zappa associate who had recently formed a riotous and abrasive ensemble, Ménage à Trois, alongside Buzz and Bunk Gardner, two brothers who played horns and winds in the Mothers of Invention. When Buckley said he needed a bass player who would wade deeper into improvisational waters, Underwood had the guy. Balkin introduced Buckley to Kathy Berberian, twisted interpretations of the works of her husband, avant-garde composer Luciano Berio. He was willing to try pretty much anything. We never had any music to read from, Balkin told Mojo in 1995. We just noodled through and went for it, just finding the right note or coming off a note and making it right. Underwood understood that his role as guru had been subsumed. Balkan would offer a bass line and tell Buckley to whistle or sing over it, then to change his key or tone and see what worked best, or how the pieces might cohere. Underwood had long encouraged Buckley to use his voice as an improvisational instrument. Now it was happening. Tim was soaring beyond whatever I knew, into new zones that Balkan knew, Underwood says. Balkan was a tremendous teacher. He wouldn't teach notes to Timmy, but he would say, "Try this." Recorded and burst in the fall of 1969, the result, Lorca, named for the revolutionary Spanish poet Federico García Lorca, who, like Buckley, integrated surrealism into romantic lines, remains one of the most esoteric and electrifying label exist ever. With Underwood and Balkan on keys, and Buckley pinballing between operatic heights and guttural gospel howls, the title track suggests surrealism and acid experiments, a lament for the way love inevitably crumbles. Anonymous proposition finds Buckley, Balkan, and Underwood conversing in rhythmic and melodic variations, the instrumentalist engaging in an intimate pas de deux with his improvisations. Here's a little bit of that song, Anonymous Proposition.
Love me, as if someday you'd hate me for what I give.
Tempting to see Lorca as some internecine exercise made to waste Elektra's money and prod Buckley's audience, like the carnation in his teeth, but it wasn't. I decided right then it was time to break open something new, because the voice with 5.5 octaves was certainly capable. We were getting real tired of writing songs that adhered to the verse, verse, chorus thing, he remembered in April 1975, drawing a state line between its animating ideas and those of In a Silent Way, which Miles Davis released month before Lorca was made. To this day, you can't put it on at a party without stopping things. It doesn't fit in. Buckley made Blue Afternoon the straightest album of his career for Cohen and Straight Records when Lorca was finished. Miller tagged in for Balkan on bass, while Friedman returned on vibraphone. These were largely songs Buckley had pushed aside as he explored improvisation. For Underwood, it felt like seeding freshly gained ground. His frustration is audible in the solo of so lonely. Underwood overplaying as if he's trying to cut the band free. And here's a little bit of that song, So Lonely, by Tim Buckley.
Well, I don't get no letters, nobody calls, nobody comes round here no more. No pretty ladies, no pretty boys, nobody comes round my door no more. It's just lonely, mama, you don't know. It's just lonely, mama, you don't know. Well, the cops treat you dirty and the children are mean. Oh, this is the lowest town I've ever seen. People keep dragging their bodies around. Ain't enough pride to even look around. It's just a lonely mama. Honey, you don't know.
Was a retreat to familiarity into trying to get some commercially viable tunes. Tim needed something to give a commercial whoop-de-doo, says Underwood. I was dismayed with the notion of playing rehearsed music, but I kept my mouth shut about my needs to move beyond folk music, beyond commercialization, and just get into improvisation. Larry Beckett's lawyer had good news and bad news. The positive was that, as best as Beckett remembers, he had earned $1,842 on songs he had written with Buckley, his high school friend and bandmate. The negative, though, was that he had $1,842 in legal fees due to the lawyer who had been working to get him out of the U.S. Army. Beckett wasn't too worried, though. After battling the army for more than a year, he was finally on his way to freedom. In June 1969, after charges of being absent without leave and desertion and time spent in a stockade, Beckett was done. When the poet settled in Portland, Oregon, with the artist he soon married, he and Buckley began catching up by phone. They talked about new songs while Buckley, still in California, sat in a recliner wearing thermal underwear and a black robe, cradling his guitar. Buckley finally decided to visit, hoping to write together for an upcoming album. Beckett's early lovesick poetry had formed the bulk of the lyrics on Buckley's debut, and he'd subsequently helped usher in the political and surrealistic aspects of the singer's repertoire. Buckley, however, had written his last three albums alone, though he allegedly turned down a chance to write music for John Schlesinger's Midnight Cowboy, since Beckett in the Army couldn't help. We collaborated on the lyrics to a song as though he were hesitant to have me go full bore without him steering it, Beckett tells Mojo from his home, still in Portland, where he has remained a poet and recently recorded an album featuring the songs of Jacques Brel. We had no experience collaborating as writers, and it was a miserable experience. It was such a forced, sour engagement, he said. Just send me the lyrics you write. Beckett wrote four new songs for the album, including the one they'd tried to pin together, I Woke Up, an anxious and impressionistic ballad about the possibility and weight of the future. And here's some of that song, I Woke Up, by Tim Buckley.
Sits on my head. Ooh. along the shore of the town.
In the fall of 1970, a year after Lorca was finished, Beckett returned to California to watch his words become the songs of Star Sailor. He was stunned. When Tim made Goodbye and Hello, he would just wander around the studio, bumping into things. He had no idea, so he was relying on the producer, Jerry Yester, to answer questions, remembers Beckett. But this time, Buckley would sing or play something, ask to hear it back, and then offer ideas in real time about what needed to change, how the pieces could fit together. He was in complete control. Any questions he was asked, he had the answer. Around the time of the session, Buckley was also penning a hilarious and acerbic editorial for the New York Times about Beethoven, full of barbs for rock musicians and fans alike. "Hardly anybody I know listens to him," he wrote. "Maybe because they can't play him on the guitar." Beckett and Buckley were also engrossed in the anatomy of Crinzel Pendricki, Toshira Maizumi, and Berio. Beckett could now hear that. The work stirred Beckett so much, he suggested they resurrect Song to the Siren, a song they'd struggled to get right in a plaintive folk yarn years earlier. Buckley harmonized with himself, his voice curling over gauzy harmonies that stretched out like galaxies. And here's a little bit of that song, Song to the Siren, by Tim Buckley.
Long afloat on shipless oceans, I did all my best to smile, till your singing eyes and fingers drew me loving to your isle, and you sang, "Sail to me, sail to me, let me enfold you. Here I am, here I am, waiting to hold you." I dream you dreamed about me. Were you here?
Underwood's spare electric guitar undergirded him, rising and falling around Buckley's swoops. Song to the Siren became Star Sailor's centerpiece, and in years to come, the calling card for Buckley's experimental legacy. It was like he came into possession of his muse, Beckett says. He was hesitant at first, and then he became stronger and stronger. Buckley overdubbed 16 vocal tracks, even running some of them backwards. For the title cut, a poem turned into a tape experiment. The returning Balkan and Gardner brothers darted in and out of I Woke Up and blared with Albert Eiler's gusto on The Healing Festival. It was astounding, and Underwood insists Buckley knew it. He said, "That's my best album." Underwood remembers, "That's my major work." And here's part of the song, The Healing Festival, by Tim Buckley. Buckley also understood it was a tough sell. True to his word, he took his Star Sailor band into jazz clubs, starting with an October 1970 date at the tiny Lion's Share near San Francisco. The band was savage, hammering and howling through a 12-minute rendition of Lorca and flowing in and out of eerie renditions of Star Sailor. Warped vocals blew like wind from a cave. The audacious music met reserved applause. He would address his crowd by saying, "Good evening, Lobos." That was his entourage slang for lobotomies, says Beckett. He meant these people had no brains, and they were not going to like this music. He had only contempt. When Buckley finished touring Star Sailor, he needed a break. He had made 3 albums in a year, and both Lorca and Star Sailor turned him into something of a punching bag. There is an annoying problem about the album. It is a collection of junk tapes, ran one former fan's review of Lorca in a student newspaper. The arrangement and selection of songs do not correspond with Buckley's usual habits. What's more, after swearing off the idea of a second marriage after a divorce in 1966, he had wed Judy Stillcliffe and became the stepfather to her son, Taylor, in April 1970. He wanted to try becoming a family man, to watch the Los Angeles Lakers play baseball with Zappa and take road trips with Judy. The drugs had sometimes been hard, the road grueling, the assorted tensions among his band members exhausting. "I'd been going strong since 1966, and I really needed a rest," he said in 1974. "I hadn't caught up with any living." Buckley was always working, according to Judy, doodling lyrics on cocktail napkins or thinking about songs, even if he didn't have his guitar. But when he promptly returned to work in 1972, it was clear he had, once again, broken with his past. He'd played the role of Glenn, an out-of-work drummer with family issues, in Why, a Victor Stoloff film about a fractious residential therapy session that ends with everyone caressing each other's faces, starring a young O.J. Simpson. It was an early experiment in shooting to videotape, but it was a flop. Buckley's character stung. "I feel like Everything that I've done, made, or believed in has been a waste of time, said Buckley, an on-screen natural. I can't live like that. Indeed, Buckley reemerged, willing to try his hand at something like stardom. He jettisoned his old band almost entirely, with only Collins returning on conga. He added strings, background singers, horns, and a rhythm section of session players. After Lorica and Star Sailor, I was pretty much irrelevant, admits Underwood. He needed to find other means because he was constantly changing. He was deeply into pop music, and I had no connection with pop music. Greetings from L.A., Buckley's seventh LP, was a funky, hokey affair. It's seven rambunctious songs inspired by listening, he said, to the radio. But many of its tunes neared the seven-minute mark. And Buckley's lyrics about foot fetishes and squeaking bed springs curbed its commercial appeal. Ball and chain on the old brain, he said in 1972, of writing songs to turn into singles. I don't see it as a compromise, though. It's just part of my life having to do something like that. He didn't stop, either, young producer Denny Randall scrubbed 1973's Sophronica until it felt smooth, sounded saccharine. Look at the Fool was a major improvement, with Beckett returning to write some lyrics. Jim Fiedler, the high school friend who introduced the two before joining Blood, Sweat, and Tears, was in on those sessions. Despite the title and his sullen face on both covers, engineer Stan Agol insisted Buckley was finding new momentum in 1974. His career was looking up, Agol said in 2000. He was leaving Herb Cohen and signing a big deal. He was not a junkie. Tim Buckley died on June 29, 1975, hours after returning to California from a short tour in Texas. He had been drunk, snorted some heroin offered by a close friend who was also his dealer, and soon died at home. That's when Buddy Helm stopped playing music. Helm had met Buckley during a failed Zappa audition, not long after Greetings from L.A. was finished. The drummer was smitten by Buckley's easygoing charm, stunned by his voice. They both adored Fred Neil and even talked about making an album with him. Their shows together were tightrope walks, Helm remembers, dovetailing moments of terror and delight. When he'd get going, it was like I was a jockey, like being on Secretariat, says Helm, and I could follow him where he wanted to go. Helm had been with him until the end, playing that string of Texas dates where Buckley had been uncharacteristically pleased with the reception and reviews. The singer had been in talks to play Woody Guthrie in Bound for Glory. The offer, the New York Times later reported, would have arrived days after he died. The drummer didn't want to deal with that kind of heartbreak again. So, Buddy Helm became Russell Helm, working in the film industry and swapping his stage clothes for Lux threads. I had to get serious, he says, laughing. My wife said I had to have a life with benefits. That, what is that? In 1983, Judy Buckley tracked down Helm. Money wasn't showing up from Warner Brothers, and she needed help from a suit, as she called him. He set up a meeting with lawyers at the label, arriving in a white silk suit from Barney's, hoping to play the part of the power broker. As he neared the appointed conference room, he recognized a famous face in a mixing room, Bruce Springsteen, in Los Angeles, working on songs. We looked at each other, Helm remembers, and a minute later he said, Tim Buckley, Max's Kansas City. Springsteen knew the former drummer was there to meet with attorneys, so he handed him his own suit, a cut-off denim jacket slung across his chair. "Go get 'em," Springsteen said. Helm walked into the room of a half-dozen attorneys. Springsteen's denim slipped over his fancy duds. When he asked if they knew who had given him the accessory, they nodded. They thought, "Oh, shit, he's crazy," says Helm, laughing. "I told them that. Without Tim, they wouldn't have a lot of artists." He was the one that was showing the way forward. They cut a deal for Judy and Taylor to get paid. It wasn't a lot, because it rarely was with Buckley. His life, as his other son Jeff once put it, was hell. But 50 years after Buckley's death, Helm's point may be more salient than ever. Buckley epitomized the idea of the restless songwriter, or anyone for whom folk music or any tune with a seemingly simple structure is not an end point, but instead an invitation to explore. This mortal coil reinforced that nearly a decade later, when their impressionistic and amorphous cover of Song to the Siren with Elizabeth Frazier became an indie hit. Jeff, too, carried the lessons of Happy Sad and Star Sailor into his own too brief career. They have persevered with subsequent generations of songwriters who could be called fearless if they didn't have such a compelling precedent in Tim Buckley. His temperamental traits show up in Bon Iver and Destroyer, M.K. Gee and Riley Walker, or anywhere someone is looking to elide preconceptions of a song and figuring out how to do it themselves, particularly with a singular voice. Tim Buckley once told a story about meeting Leontine Price, the pioneering opera singer who could make even the high notes sound like thunder. She saw his Star Sailor band in New York and confided that she wished someone would write music like that for opera. But he hadn't waited for someone to write that music for a folk singer. He'd just done it. "Well, do what I did," he quipped. "Get your own band." Here's a side article titled, "I Made a Horrible Mistake." Richard Keeling gave Buckley heroin the night he died, but doesn't believe it killed him. "One thing I understood at the time was drugs," he tells Grayson Curran. For several years, Richard Keeling has considered writing a memoir called The Man Who Killed Tim Buckley. On July 9, 1975, less than 2 weeks after Buckley's death in Los Angeles, Keeling was arraigned for heroin distribution and murder. 4 months later, he instead pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter, ultimately serving 4 months in prison. "That deal," he says, "was his real error. I made a horrible mistake by accepting that, by following my lawyer's instructions," Keeling tells Mojo from Japan, where he moved in 2023. "What I should have done was say, 'Come at me, take my chances,' I would have been not guilty." Keeling and Buckley met in 1969 when his wife and Buckley's partner, Janie, had become friends. Since he scored his first bit of weed in junior high, Keeling sold drugs to friends, hoping to turn enough profit to pay for his own supply in the early 70s. He was a new student in UCLA's Ethnomusicology program, getting by with a nighttime job at a pizza parlor. He'd get off work around the time Buckley would return from gigs, so they'd party late into the night. "I would turn him on, and he would get me backstage," says Keeling, who Buckley dubbed CR, or Cool Richard. "I got treated really well." I'm 80, and I don't care if I die any time. I've had 6 lifetimes, says Keeling, who went on to get his doctorate, become a professor, and do important research about the music of indigenous people in the United States. But it's really sad when someone who's not even 30 dies. Of course, I felt bad about that. I felt even worse that I took the blame. And I promise next week I'll read the interview with Moody Blues singer Justin Haywood, so we have time for the classic album review this week, which is Into the Great Wide Open by Tom Petty. Tom Petty continued his impressive commercial success as a new decade unfolded with Into the Great Wide Open, the 8th studio album by Petty and the Heartbreakers. This album combined the group's traditional rock sensibilities dating back to the mid-1970s with the mainstream production techniques of his various projects of the late 1980s. With this combination, Into the Great Wide Open received various bits of warm critique to go along with its pop success. Petty's previous album with the Heartbreakers, 1987's Let Me Up, I've Had Enough, received mixed reviews and was the first album by the group not to reach the top 10 of the U.S. album charts in nearly a decade. The following year, Petty formed the supergroup, the Travelin' Wilburys, along with George Harrison, Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison, and Jeff Lynne, and their debut album, Volume 1, had great success. Even greater success followed in 1989 when Petty released his debut solo album, Full Moon Fever, which was co-produced by Lynne and included 4 top 40 singles. Heartbreakers guitarist Mike Campbell was the only member of the backing group to play on Full Moon Fever. With expectations very high, Petty once again enlisted Lynne as co-producer for Into the Great Wide Open, and the pair employed a methodical, nearly formulaic approach to the compositions. Lynne also played various instruments throughout, which seemed to limit much of the Heartbreakers' expressiveness and offered the group members sparse moments to shine musically and rhythmically. The album's first 3 tracks were the most radio-friendly. Learning to Fly features moderately picked harmonized chords to leave an indelible musical impression, along with Campbell's later slide guitar expertly cutting through the pristine soundscape. The song became one of the top hits for Petty and the Heartbreakers. And here's a little bit of that song, Learning to Fly, by Tom Petty.
Well, I started out down a dirty road. Started out all alone. And the sun went down as I crossed the hill. And the town lit up. The world got still. I'm learning to fly, but I ain't got wings. Coming down is the hardest thing.
King's Highway follows as a crisp driving rocker with subtle guitar layers and a simple hook and message with a promise of better days. The album's title song is a slightly dark folk storyteller with more fine slide guitars and some memorable rudiments that drive the song along. Two Gunslingers is actually a song of peace with much allegory and the lyrical epiphany of taking control of one's life, while The Dark of the Sun has a quasi-pop country feel which morphs into harder rocking later, making for a potent and diverse track. All or Nothing is an intense dark rocker with Campbell's slide topping a steady thumping rhythm by bassist Howie Epstein, while All the Wrong Reasons leans toward more traditional folk lyrically, with Benmont Tench adding some accordion for color and Byrds legend Roger McGuinn providing backing vocals. After the forgettable track Too Good to Be True, the album's second side becomes more interesting, starting with the refreshing hard rocker Out in the Cold, featuring Petty's more expressive and strained vocals. You and I Will Meet Again is a solo composition with a classic Petty feel that leaves plenty of room for musical chops by each lead player, while Making Some Noise features interesting rockabilly-style riffs that are later contrasted by a short but effective wah-wah fused lead by Campbell. The closer, Built to Last, has an overall sound different than anything else on the album, rhythmically deadened but pleasant throughout. Into the Great Wide Open would turn out to be the final studio release on the MCA label, as well as the final with drummer Stan Lynch, who was replaced by Steve Ferrone in 1994. To wrap up their decade and a half with MCA, the group released a greatest hits album in 1993, which became their top seller overall and went platinum a dozen times over. And once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the most current July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to read the short interview that I didn't get to this week with Justin Haywood of the Moody Blues. And then I'm going to read an article about guitarist Rory Gallagher since his death 30 years ago, and a classic album review of American Four by Johnny Cash. Until then, this is Andy Bomick for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
And the rocks might melt, and the sea may burn.